This is Conor Lennon from UN News. Some countries are defining whomever they like as terrorists and exhibiting deep and problematic inconsistencies over how they treat family members of suspected extremists in places like northeast Syria and Iraq. That's according to Finola Ni-Aeloin, the UN independent human rights expert dealing with counter-terrorism. She says that many of the women and children associated with former ISIL terrorist fighters are themselves victims, and it's a big mistake to curb their rights or define them simply by association. Ms. Ni-Aeloin was at UN headquarters a few days ago to deliver her annual report to the General Assembly. She told Matt Wells what her main message had been.
The context of that report is that protecting and promoting human rights in the context of countering terrorism has never been more fragile and more precarious. The foothold of human rights remains very tenuous and the footprint extremely light. There were two specific issues that my report addressed. The first was the proliferation of what I call soft law in the area of counterterrorism. Soft law seems like an oxymoron because law is usually hard. But in the absence of a binding treaty on terrorism since 9/11...
No one can really clearly define it.
Well, it's clear that states have struggled to define it, let's say. But we do have some very clear definitions of acts of terrorism. But in the absence of a treaty, states have not stood still. They have chosen to enact large and proliferating amounts of law through these mechanisms of soft law. And my concern is that much of that soft law is a human rights-free zone, that there's almost no substantive content and that there's almost no procedures to ensure the insertion of human rights. And that is an enormous problem in the context of protecting and promoting human rights globally.
So in a sense, states get away with the fact that, you know, most people in the world see terrorism, as the ultimate evil, if you like, and terrorists are often condemned before the facts have been established.
I think it's even more pernicious than that, actually. I think that because we don't have a global definition of terrorism, states have been left free to define whomever they like as a terrorist. And so what we're finding at the domestic level is some countries, for example, consider women asking for the right to drive as terrorists and prosecute them under terrorism legislation. Some states consider persons who protest peacefully in the streets demanding their right of political participation to be terrorists under their domestic law. Some, for example, legislation says any kind of insult or, quote, dishonour to the state constitutes terrorism. So these definitions are so wide, it means that in practice, what terrorism, anti-terrorism work in many states involves is simply locking up or restraining or limiting or administratively sanctioning those who happen to disagree with you. And that right, the right to disagree, the right to express, the right to protest, the right to participate freely in public affairs, are all rights protected by our most fundamental treaties, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and by the Universal Declaration. So it's a huge problem.
So apart from soft law, what was the other main point you wanted to make?
The second point was that increasingly much of this law is being made in new institutions, institutions actually that sit outside of the UN, institutions that are not part of the traditional multilateral space. My report looks at two of those. One is the Global Counterterrorism Forum. The other is the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force. Both of these entities are small clubs of states who come together through mutual self-interest. But it's exclusive. Many states, you know, we know that lawmaking is messy for states. And when you have lots of states, it's even more messy. But that's part of the barter, the fundamental notion that all states are equal and have sovereign equality in the lawmaking process. When we create these new institutions, and those are the institutions that are producing much of this soft law, we're actually not only excluding human rights, because there's very little fundamental structural engagement with human rights by these bodies, but also large numbers of states don't get to participate. And I think that's a problem from the point of view of sovereign equality. It's also a human rights problem.
Obviously, this week, terrorists and those who are associated with alleged terrorists have been very much in the news when it comes to northeastern Syria and for many years also, of course, in Iraq as well. I mean, what are your concerns about how events are progressing this week with a special relevance to those families and clearly children of alleged terrorists who are in great danger now? Yeah.
So the mandate has issued a public position. It's on the mandate's website at the Office of the High Commission's webpage. In that, we make a number of observations and recommendations to states. The first is to remember, as many states are failing to remember, that they have legal obligations to their citizens who find themselves overseas. Those include not just human rights obligations, but consular assistance obligations. Those are well entrenched and well established in international law. The second thing is to remind ourselves that many of these individuals, women and children, are in fact victims. They are also victims of terrorism. I had the good fortune or the responsibility to be in Kazakhstan in May this year when Kazakhstan repatriated 241 citizens from women and children from Iraq and Syria. And I interviewed many of those women and their children. And what was painfully obvious is that many of these girls went to Syria and Iraq when they were minors. They first had sex, often unconsentingly, as minors, which in many Western countries would be statutory rape under domestic law. They gave birth to children in non-consenting circumstances. And those children themselves are children protected by the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We cannot and should not ever define women by association to a particular man. If that is the departure of states, that's a profoundly illegitimate and, frankly, undermining of the most basic notion of equality for women.
So for those who say, well, they deserve what they got, they went, they made the decision to go.
And surely we wouldn't apply that principle, for example, to women who experience domestic violence, or we wouldn't apply it to women who find themselves in precarious circumstances in many domestic situations. We wouldn't say you chose to marry that person or follow that person and therefore you have no protection under law. It seems to me that that kind of slippery slope is enormously dangerous, not just in Iraq and Syria, but on the fundamental notion that we treat individuals individually. We assess what they have done individually. The mandate has clearly taken the view if women have been responsible for criminal acts, as they are in any country in the world, they should be held responsible under the criminal law. But bring them home and try them in under fair trial
with
conditions,
due process.
With due process, not in states that will subject their acts to the death penalty, not in states where other special rapporteurs, for example, the special rapporteur on summary and arbitrary executions who visited Iraq in the last 2 years, has pointed out in situations where there are deep fair trial concerns, deep concerns about the conditions of detention. And most of all, I would say we are long past the time where we should be producing circulars, guidelines, having endless conversations and unfortunate hand-wringing about what to do about this problem. Bear in mind that in other circumstances, the UN, for example, and states have committed to addressing the problem of sexual violence and armed conflict. The UN has a special office for dealing with children in armed conflict. So is it suddenly that all of these rights that we and obligations that we say apply to women and children in certain conflicts are selective, that we get to choose which conflicts we give those entitlements and benefits and protections to? It seems to me that would be an abrogation of the most fundamental kind and show a deep and very problematic inconsistency with long-term consequences for the notion of the role of the rule of law, of equality under law, and the right for any individual, woman or child, to be treated in their own right and to be assessed in their own right and to be treated humanely and with dignity, not based on the person to whom they happen to be associated by virtue of birth or by virtue of marriage, forced or otherwise.